With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Do you want to know what it's like to hang out with MS-13 in El Salvador? How the Russian mafia fought battles all over Brooklyn in the 1990s.
Or what about that time I got lost in the Burmese jungle hunting the world's biggest meth lab? Or why the Japanese Yakuza have all those crazy dragon tattoos? I'm Sean Williams.
And I'm Danny Gold. And we're the host of the Underworld podcast. We're journalists that have traveled all over, reporting on dangerous people and places. And every week, we'll be bringing you a new story about organized crime from all over the world.
We know this stuff because we've been there. We've seen it. And we've got the near misses and embarrassing tales to go with it. We'll mix in reporting with our own experiences in the field, and we'll throw in some bad jokes while we're at it.
The Underworld Podcast explores the criminal underworlds that affect all of our lives, whether we know it or not. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
That's the night traditionally when the borders between this world and the other world are completely open. And so it's from this cave in these tales on Samhain night and Halloween night that all sorts of creatures emerge to devastate the land so nothing will grow until the following spring.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how's it going today?
Oh, it's going so well today, Tim. You know why? You know why?
Why?
Because we are entering the season of Samhain.
That's correct. And you may have noticed we've even got a different logo for the month of October to represent Halloween. And this is a very Halloween-centric episode where we're actually discussing where Halloween came from.
The origin story of Halloween, and this came to us by way of a random notification on our phones that directed us to this article about these hell caves that are apparently the birthplace of Halloween, and they are located in the extremely small community of Rathcrohan, Ireland.
And we were lucky enough to speak with a fellow who runs tours over there. His name is Mike McCarthy, a really well-spoken guy and a lot of fun to talk to about these legendary tales and just some history about Ireland and Samhain, Lance. Is that how you pronounce it? Samhain?
I think it could go Samhain or Samhain.
Okay.
It looks like Samhain.
Right.
So folks out there, I had pronounced that Samhain for years. It's actually Samhain. Or Samhain.
But it's basically Halloween, right?
It is the time of the year where you're changing seasons from the summer to the winter. So you're harvesting your crops and you're preparing the land to enter winter. So that's the doorway of the spirits. And that's essentially where costumes come from, collecting things from your neighbors comes from. And we've sort of translated that, or it's morphed into kids putting on costumes and going door to door trick or treating and getting candy. And you can hear Mike tell the story of this and the origin of it. And it's incredibly cool. You might want to slow it down. This might be one of those episodes where you don't listen at 1.5. You might want to listen at 0.5 because this is a guy who's very Irish and loves to tell the story. And he's quite a good storyteller. And I don't want you to miss anything.
Apparently, I missed where egging people on Halloween came from in Ireland. I guess that didn't come from Ireland, but I do understand where the rest of the traditions now came from because of this conversation. And so it's fun, it's educational, and it's a nice history lesson, but it doesn't feel boring to learn.
And we referenced the article in National Geographic, and you can check that out by going to nationalgeographic.com. The story was composed by and photography was taken by Ronan O'Connell. So it was a very good, about a 10-minute read, really interesting. And then make your way over to the Rathcrohan Visitor Center website. And the link to that is in the show notes. And this is the organization that our guest, Mike McCarthy, works for and does tours with.
All right, everyone. I hope you enjoy this episode and have a great Halloween.
Celebrate Samhain safely.
No egging.
Use those eggs for an omelet instead.
Welcome to the podcast. Mike McCarthy, how are you today?
Good. Good to be with you.
It's fantastic having you here. Just a quick little bit of background on why you were on the show today. Sometimes I get these random news bulletins or notifications that pop up on my phone, and I received one that was a link to an article about the origin of Halloween and these Irish hell caves. Immediately I click on it and then immediately send it to Tim to say, like, we have to get this guy on, Mike McCarthy, who is very familiar with the region, the background, the folklore, and you were gracious enough to join us. So thank you very much for doing that. And honestly, like, it's very cool to talk to somebody who's in Ireland right now, and I'm going to apologize for the absolute murdering of some of these names that will happen during the conversation.
Not at all. You're absolutely grand. Well, one thing I could say maybe that, and thanks very much again for having me. One thing I think we could maybe put paid to would be the term hell is a little bit strong, you know, and there's a reason maybe why this monument you refer to, this cave, achieved that moniker. But we tend to try and maybe dispel that myth that it's an entrance to what's referred to as the other world. We spent quite a bit of time, as you say, we're tour guides here around in this landscape. We have a visitor interpretive center museum here in the center of Rathcrohan, and we spend quite a lot of time down there. So I think we can testify that it's certainly not a gate to hell, or if it is, we've come back as well. But it's recorded in our medieval literature, this cave that you refer to, as an entrance to the other world. And this other world is a very uniquely Irish concept, because it's not an underworld. It's not a place like, say, Hell or Hades or Valhalla, because you don't have to die in order to access it. So there's various ways to get into it. It's a parallel dimension, if you like, that surrounds us all about. Some ways to go is to sail far off over the sea to the west. We know now we'd probably end up in your house if we went that way, that we wouldn't come to the other world. Sometimes it's thought to be deep beneath the earth. So areas like wells, caves particularly, and bogs with deep pools of stagnant water were seen as areas of access to it. And then we have these monuments, early medieval monuments in Ireland, referred to as ring forts. Now, ring forts are early farmsteads, and they're left, if you like, as earthen features on the landscape, dotted left, right and center around the country. There's actually approximately 48,000 of them still extant on the landscape as well. But colloquially, they're referred to as fairy forts. And these are thought to be dwelling places of the beings who dwell in the other world. And as I say, traditionally as well, these are seen as areas of access into this dimension, if you like. So it's said to be again colloquially inhabited, this other world, by what are referred to as the fairy folk of Ireland. But these aren't fairies, if you like, in the Disney Tinkerbell sense. These are much more formidable individuals. These are the if you like, the immortals of Ireland, the people in legend who lived here before we arrived. They fought a great battle up at a place called Teltown in County Meath, were defeated and then went to inhabit, as I say, this otherworldly dimension that can be accessed by certain routes and also at certain times of the year.
I feel like I deserve a degree now in in this subject matter. That's absolutely fascinating. And before we, oh, no pun intended, go deeper into the topic, can you give a little bit of a background on yourself and maybe the geography of where this is located, you know, in the scope of Ireland?
Absolutely. As I say, I'll carry on and feel free to interrupt me as well. But my background is originally I would be in a second career here, if you like. I originally qualified as a pharmacist. So I had a scientific background. I was worked as a community pharmacist for nearly 20 years. And then I had a huge love of Irish mythology and history. And so that brought me approximately 7 years ago to this site here. This is area of Rathcrohan, is what's described as the prehistoric royal site, a royal capital of Connacht, the Western province. Some of your listeners, I'm sure, are very familiar where we're located here. And so I then did a qualification through here in archaeology as well. So I would be on a second career here. So we have a museum visitor center here, an interpretive center. So what we do is we interpret the landscape all about us here for visitors, as I say, through museums, through guided tours, and through our publications as well. So that's my background. That's what keeps me off the streets as well. And the visitor center here is actually, it's a community run group. So it's a not-for-profit center. Anything that it makes or takes goes back into the minding, the keeping, the promotion, and if you like, of the landscape all about us here. Like, and as I say, it's, I suppose, getting it wider known to a wider audience, and also to mind it, preserve it, and to keep it. And so if anyone wants to check it out, it's our website is Rathcrohan, www.rathcrohan.ie. There's all sorts of things you can get onto there. You can check out. We have virtual tours. You can take a virtual journey into the cave down through it there as well, if you don't want to cross the Atlantic to do it. And it'll tell you a little bit all about it and all our various publications and activities as well. So that's my own background. That's as I say, that's what keeps me off the streets and keeps the public safe from me. So
now, one thing I'm curious about is, how can you be so sure these caves don't lead to hell? Like, how deep have you gone?
As well, what this cave you refer to today, Tim, wouldn't be, if you like, it wouldn't be that substantial a cave anymore. So what we're left with, and it's important for me to stress, what we're left with today are the underground remains of what would have been a more substantial structure. So there's a natural underground limestone cave, about 40 meters of it remains underneath the ground today as well. It's accessed then by what's referred to as the souterrain. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but a souterrain is a man-made passage or entrance. And actually, it's directly behind you there. What you're looking at is the entrance. It's a crawl space into the cave as well. And so this would have been, souterrains generally tend to date to the early medieval period. So anywhere between the 5th and the 10th century. So you'd be talking maybe 1500 to 1000 years ago. This dry stone structure would have been constructed. So you can see it's well stacked kind of in around you as well. There's a technique called, as I'm looking out there, I'm looking out towards the entrance, but to my right hand side, as I'm looking towards you, it would carry on down. There's what's known as a corbelled roof on it. It's a structure of supporting lintel stones, roof stones right down. And that goes on for about 9 to 10 meters. So all told, what's left today underground is about 50 meters of an underground cave. So we would daily travel down into it and have a look around it. So I'm fairly sure it doesn't lead into hell anymore anyway at that rate. So.
Okay. Now, why people say that it did?
That's bringing you back, I suppose, to an idea of where this cave is situated and the landscape that it's on. So as I say, it's situated in Rathcrohan or Cruachan, which is the Irish for it as well. And that's described as the prehistoric royal site of Connacht. So these royal sites, if you like, in Ireland, in times long ago, before you have any towns or roads or villages or cities, you only begin to get the first towns founded in Ireland in the 9th century, approximately, with the company of the Vikings. I'm sure you're familiar with those as well. So cities like Dublin, Cork, Waterford, Limerick, those are originally Viking settlements. Before that, in Ireland, you've got a much more smaller, scattered farming population, a country largely covered in bog and forest as well. And these royal sites then traditionally would have been used as places of gathering. So when people needed to come together, and because they're a farming community, particularly times important to agriculture, so times like spring, summer, harvest and winter, which is Samhain, the original Irish Halloween, the winter festival as well, people would have gathered here together. They're monikered then the royal sites because these great assemblies, or éinigí they're referred to in Irish, and they were particularly associated then with the crowning and the inauguration of kings. So when you get then, as I say, these are places of very important assembly of ceremony. And so then in the 5th century, say approximately 1500 to 1600 years ago, when you get Christianity coming to Ireland, you find then that possibly to ease the conversion process, a large reuse of already important places, sites and things like that by the Christians when they come. So, for example, the royal site in Ulster, our equivalent up in County Armagh, is referred to as Aman Maca. So the diocesan centre of the Catholic Church and the Church of Ireland is located in Armagh, just less than 500 metres from that site. St. Patrick, I'm sure you're familiar with him, and same as ourselves, his biographers record him coming here to Cruachan, founding churches, erecting standing stones in around and thing like that. And so you find the Christianization of already, if you like, cultural phenomenon and places around that time. But when the early Christian scribes, when they came to deal with this entrance to the other world, I suppose it sort of it stumped them. And so they monikered it in one text as Doris Ifrin na Héireann. So Doris is the Irish for door, Éireann for Ireland, and Ifrin, as you can probably deduce from that, as entrance to hell. But I think it might have been done as a little bit tongue-in-cheek, if you like, as well. Maybe it's not quite an entrance to hell. But this other world, as I say, it's a unique dimension because it can be a paradise-like world as well, but it can also be a slightly malevolent place as well, depending on how you go there and what time and what's happening around as well. So maybe a little bit suspicious of that monument. They didn't have a reuse for it, so maybe that's where the moniker came from.
Yeah, fill us in a little bit on this malevolence that you're talking about, because I feel like that's got some root in American Halloween as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so when you're looking, I suppose, I say at the four pre-Christian, if you like, Irish or Gaelic festivals, you have Imbolc, which is springtime, Beltane, which is summer, Lunasa, which is harvest, and then Samhain, which is the original Irish winter festival. And because this Samhain, if you like, it's the night that borders the seasons of summer and winter, that's the night traditionally when the borders between this world and the other world are completely open. So you have to consider, for a farming community who are directly dependent on their landscape, on their environment for their survival, I mean, as I say, at that time, survival is a hard game. If you have no means, maybe over winter time, to feed your cattle, you're going to, if you like, have to slaughter the majority year upon year. A bad harvest or a bad year would be disaster, probably beyond what we could comprehend. The threat of starvation would never be very far behind you as well. So it's, I suppose, at Samhain at winter, this is your last chance to have a celebration, if you like, before you prepare for facing three or four very, very hard months ahead. And as I say, because this night traditionally, Samhain, is the night that borders summer and winter, that's the night traditionally when the borders between this world and the other world are completely open. Now, it's interesting, this cave you refer to here, in all of our epic medieval literature, there's a whole body, if you like, of literature associated with this site here of Rathcrochan, because as I say, what we know now today about it is that it's actually a ceremonial site. We've got burial monuments here, high status dwelling places, all of those things as well. But in our epic literature, it's the site where the Táin Bó Cúnaithe begins and ends. So I don't know if you're familiar with this. This is a tale called The Cattle Raid of Cooley. And for Ireland, this would be the equivalent of our Iliad and our Odyssey rolled into one. It's our national epic, and it involves a very famous figure called Queen Maeve. I don't know if you've come across her. She rules Connacht from here, and the war she has with King Conor Mac Nessa of Ulster as well. So, and this great cattle raiding tale where she invades his territory to steal an animal known as the Brown Bull of Cooley. So, as I say, for Ireland, it's our national epic. But what's lovely for us here in Cruachan is it begins and ends here. So there's a huge body of folklore and mythology associated with this site. This is all written down for us. They're set, these tales of the Ulster cycle, they refer to back in the Iron Age, so maybe approximately 2,000 years ago, but they're written down for us by monks in the medieval period, maybe up to, if you like, anywhere between the 7th and the 12th centuries. So this cave of Cruachan that you're referring to occurs right throughout this epic literature as well. And so it's from this cave in these tales on Samhain night and Halloween night that all sorts of creatures emerge to devastate the land, so nothing will grow until the following spring. So every Samhain night, a flock of birds, and their breath is so horrid, it causes all the leaves and berries to rot in the trees, comes flying out of this otherworldly cave. Three wild boar come out everywhere they walk. The ground withers in their wake. Nothing will grow again where they've walked as well. Triple-headed monsters comes out of there, female werewolves, all sorts of these, if you like, demonic or ghastly creatures on Halloween night. So nothing will grow until the following spring. Now, this is a night, I suppose, because the other world is much, much closer. You're not supposed to be out and about. But if you did want to go out, the reason people used to dress and disguise themselves is they would disguise themselves as one of these creatures so they wouldn't be taken back down through the cave and into the other world. So isn't it interesting, as I say, where the custom of disguising yourself as something malevolent, if you like, on the night of Halloween comes back, not only, if you like, to the original Irish festival of Samhain, but to some of the customs and stories associated directly with the remains of this monument in its day one of the most important sacred places in the country. I think if you've seen from that article you looked at there, it's on private farmland. What's on the top is mostly destroyed. There's some of the underground remains there. Everything has an origin point if you go back far enough. Often they're lost, but we're very lucky, if you'd like, just to have this very unique monument in all of Ireland still there for us today. So as I say, wherever you are on Halloween night in the world and you hear it knock on the door and the kids are there and they're trick-or-treating, I don't know what they disguise themselves as these days. There can be all sorts of funny interpretations, but where that tradition of dressing at Halloween, as I say, comes back not only to Ireland and to the original winter festival of Samhain, but particularly to this monument here in Rathcrohan of Oinagat, so Uvnagat. So.
Wow. Okay. I feel so embarrassed because I love Halloween. I love the season. And I had no idea that that's where it came from. And that's why I think I might have had like half an idea that why people dressed up. But I didn't have the full idea. And I feel embarrassed because it's like my favorite holiday. I also feel embarrassed because I've always pronounced it Samhain because that's how it looks when
that's
it's
true,
Samhain.
Yeah, so when you get the MH together in Irish, there's no W in the Irish alphabet. And so sometimes you get a combination of letters to make the necessary sound. So when you find an MH together, it makes the W sound. So that's
The
only thing for that. So yeah, so a phonetic spelling would be with a W, if you like that. But I'd say that's why. But I mean, if you looked at it directly and you pronounced it, you would say, of course, you would say Samhain, but it's Samhain.
God, 15 minutes in and I feel like 100 times smarter.
Absolutely. Well, that's good. That's how I feel. I wouldn't want to listen to me too much.
I disagree. So back then, people would dress up to scare away spirits that was the idea.
Well, the thing is, I suppose this other world, it's a place that you can go to. It's very well known, actually. In various tales as well. In later tales, you might be familiar with the Fianna and Fionn MacCool, maybe. And his son Oisin goes to this place referred to as Tírna an Óg in Ireland, which is the land of everlasting youth. A lot of cultures, if you like, have something like that. This Tírna an Óg is one and the same. So it's a paradise world often. So people never grow old there. There's a never-ending supply of food. Time flows differently as well. So it's, as I say, it can be a paradise-like world, but it also can be quite a malevolent world. And there's a very famous story actually associated with this cave called in Irish Ectra Nira, which are the strange adventures of Nira. Now Nira is an Iron Age warrior and he's one of the best in Queen Maeve, that I refer to this Queen of Connacht and the Thal, one of the best in her army. On one Samhain night, on Halloween night, Nira witnesses an army of the other world emerge right out of the cave from where you are there, Tim, so you could be in a dangerous position there as well. They come out on Samhain night and they attack and destroy and burn Queen Maeve's palace here in Cruachan to the ground. Now Nira, he sees his army heading back down through the cave, bearing the heads of his friends away on spikes. So he gives chase to them because the entrance to the other world is open, and he enters the other world down through the cave. And so while he's there, the king of the other world, he discovers him. But he takes pity on him. He doesn't kill him. He gives him a wife, a job, a role in society. His job there is actually to gather wood, if you like, as well. So as I say, he's in this paradise-like dimension. But after 3 days down in this other world, he begins to lament for his friends that he lost near. And so he says to his wife, you know, I feel terrible. I've lost my friends. And she tells him, actually, what you saw never happened. It's a vision of what will happen on the following Samhain, next Halloween, if you don't return and warn Maeve and her husband, the King Aliel, about what's going to happen. So Nira emerges back up through the cave. Now, he spent 3 days down there, but he finds his friends sitting around the fire as if no time had passed at all, because, as I say, time flows differently in this other world. I mentioned Oisin when he goes to Tírna an Óg. He spends 1 year there. When he returns to Ireland, 300 years have passed. The opposite happened to Nira. He went down to the cave for 3 days. When he comes back, no time has passed at all. So, as I say, time flows funnily in this dimension. Now, Nira returns at Samhain at wintertime, but the way he proves the story to Maeve that he's telling the truth is he bears with him from out of the cave, out of the other world, the fruits of summer. So he brings wild primrose, golden fern, garlic to lay down before the queen so she knows he's telling the truth. And the following Samhain, when the entrance to the other world is open once again, Maeve and her husband Aliel, they have their army ready and they invade the cave and they beat the otherworldly host and army. They rout them, they destroy the Sidhe, and they gather huge treasure from out of there and bring them up to their palace in this world. But while Nira has been gone, his wife has given birth to a son. And because he spent a year now up in this world, this son is now a fully grown man. And so Nira decides to remain. And the monk who wrote down that tale for us way back in the medieval period. He wrote down at the end, he'll stay down there in the cave till doomsday. He's never going to come out. Now, I haven't come across him. I don't know, maybe you can see him down there to your left somewhere, Tim, but I haven't come across him down there yet. But there, as you say, is something that happens to Nera. He has a very strange experience down in that cave. And it's, as I say, one of the few stories associated with it that happens at that time.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors. And now we're back to the program.
And actually, an interesting one springs to mind, if I'm not jumping ahead of you at all there as well, comes from when you mentioned the name, so as Oi na Gat. So in Irish, that's the anglicized or English version of Uamh na Gat. So Uamh is the Irish for a cave, na of the, and Gat is genitive plural of cat, so cave of the cats. And that also comes from, or possibly comes from an echo of another foretale or background tale of the great Thonbo Cooney, the cattle raid of Cooley, a story called Brickru's Feast. And this Brickru character is a warrior of Ulster, and he meets his death actually down here in Cruachan, which is another day's work. But he's a troublemaker, Brickru. He's a satirist. And his poetry is said to be so sharp that it can actually make a big boil or a blister rise up on your face. Now, back at that time, physical perfection was a very important matter. For example, a king couldn't be king unless he was completely unblemished. So a man who had the ability to disfigure you with his tongue alone was a very dangerous character. His full name actually in Irish was Brickru Nevtanga, which means wicked tongue or poison tongue. And he's also often compared actually to the Irish equivalent of the Norse god Loki, you know, this mischief-making character as well, not to be trusted. And in the story of Brickru's Feast, he throws a great feast where he wants all the warriors of Ulster to attend, and they don't want to do it because they know he's up to no good. But eventually, after he threatens to wreak havoc across the whole island, they have to agree to this feast. And so before it begins, he tells the three champions of Ulster, Cú Chulainn, you may have come across this warrior, Cú Chulainn. He's something like the Irish version of Achilles, if you like. He's the ultimate warrior, if you like, Cú Chulainn, another warrior called Conall Cearnach, and another called Liadh Ar Buíochas. He tells each of the three warriors that they're entitled to the champion's portion at the feast. This is usually the roasted hindquarters of a pig, and it's presented to the foremost warrior. So before the feast begins, he tells each of the guys, you know, you're the man, you should claim it. The feast begins, the champion's portion is brought forth, and the three warriors stand up to claim it. And of course, all holy hell breaks loose, which is what Brickru wanted. The three warriors, they destroy the feast in the feasting hall, and they go rampaging around the country competing over this trophy portion. At one stage, they take themselves down to Connacht to gain a judgment from Queen Maeve. And so they arrive up here, and to test them, Queen Maeve releases three magical wildcats from out of the cave. Again, Tim, you're right in the line of fire there. Anything could run over your armies, cats, you name it, wild boar, magical birds.
Really picked the wrong virtual background.
I was going to say, you know, he could be in danger. You're probably all right for another 2 weeks, maybe, until Halloween. So maybe you're okay for the moment. So these three cats are released, and if you like, to separate themselves, the warriors have to spend the night with them. In the morning, Conall and Nera, two of the warriors, are hanging from the rafters, terrified, while Cú Chulainn, if you like, the foremost warrior, is sitting in the corner, eating his trophy portion of meat, whacking on the nose of the sword any cat who deigns to come near him. It's how he becomes declared champion of Ulster. And again, as a foretale of the great Thonbo Cooney, the cattle raid of Cooley, how he becomes worthy to defend it in that epic tale. But maybe an echo, if you like, of these three magical wildcats that come out of the cave, maybe an echo in the modern day name, the Cave of the Cats, as well. We can't say for sure, but if you like, there's a possible reason for the moniker.
I'm going to say it's definitely because of that. But what about sacrifices? It wasn't because of any animals being sacrificed over there, right?
Well, you can't say as well. So, and a point in that is, as I say, I mentioned in the 5th century, you get the coming of Christianity to Ireland. And with that, that brings the Latin alphabet. And that's the first attempts to put the Irish language down into writing. So before that in Ireland, when you're getting on to kind of a pre-Christian period, we have no written history from back in that time. So we know that people were religious, we know they believed things, but what they did, we can't say for sure. And so that's, if you like, where when you come to that article you refer to as well, there's some severe artistic license has been taken in it, if you like, with that. So as I say, what people were doing in prehistoric Ireland, we can conjecture, we can propose, but we cannot say for sure as well. We know, for example, that they were certainly religious because they treated their dead and they buried them with grave goods, things like that as well. But what specific form that religion took, we cannot say as well. So, but as I say, you only begin to get written history, and all of this history before that in Ireland, as much as we know, our tradition would have been something like we're doing now, a passage of knowledge down orally. So a lot of that would have been lost if it wasn't for these, if you like, medieval monks recording all these early tales for us in Irish as well. They, as I say, they were learned scholars. They were recording biblical psalters, various texts in Latin, but they were the first group to write, if you like, these tales down for us in the Irish language. And so that's when we get our first written history, plus all these myths and legends as well. It's fantastic. And in fact, actually, where you are, Tim, right behind you, if you can see the stone right behind your head, that's what's referred to as an Ulm stone. So I don't know, can you see the markings along that lintel stone there?
Oh, yeah, right on the top.
Mm. So I don't know. So that's actually the earliest form of Irish writing, Ulm. And so it dates anywhere from the 4th century onwards. So it's a primitive form of script. And each of those little groups of carvings along the stem line of the corner represent a letter. And so Ulm stones is about 420 approximately still remaining between Ireland, Western Scotland and Wales. They're usually standing stones to mark a grave or a border. They're like a signpost, if you like. So they might contain a family or a place name as well. And so that one directly behind you there has been recycled, if you like, deliberately reused in the construction of the souterrain, the man-made entrance there in the medieval period. And the inscription on that, the stone on it reads, the stone of Freyoc, son of Maeve. So it's, which is Vricky Mocky Maeve. So Maeve, if it's our own Queen Maeve that it refers to this, if you like, mythical Iron Age warrior queen, if it is, and I suppose it's in her home place there, that's the earliest written reference we have to her on the island of Ireland. The warrior Freyoc that's referred to on it there is another warrior from these Ulster cycles of tales. And this warrior Freyoc, before the thaw and the great cattle raid to Cooley, he arrives down here to Rathcrohan because he wants to marry Maeve and Aliel's daughter Finnevar. She's a very famous beauty, and Freyoc is said to be the most handsome man in the island of Ireland or in Scotland. So obviously he was a very good looking man, as you can tell, we're all a very, very handsome race indeed as well. He's successful with his wooing, but before, if you like, this happens, Maeve and Aliel are afraid that the couple are going to elope and that they won't receive her dowry, her bride price. And so they try to kill Freyoc initially. They try to do him in. They put him swimming in a pool where a water serpent lives. He receives a terrible wound. And while he's lying on his sickbed in Rathcrohan, a host of women of the other world, because Freyoc was a much beloved warrior, he was one of the most famous warriors in Connacht, came out of the cave of the Sea of Cruachan there, bore his body back down into the other world, and returned him the next day completely unblemished, warrior-like, king-like once again. And now we come down here all this time later and we find his name written up on the front door. And if it tells you anything, it tells you at least that the people who constructed the souterrain, maybe anything up to 1500 years ago, that they're aware of this tale. This is a medieval tale. It's contained again in some of our great medieval epic texts as well, that they're aware of this tale the same as we are as well, that they've placed his name over the door. They know what's happened, if you like, to this warrior back down there. So it's a lovely signpost, if you like, and a lovely link with times past that we're considering when we come down to this cave, this entrance to the other world. Some of the same stories and myths and legends that these people were aware of at that time as well. So a nice link, if you like, straight to times past.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And are you directly involved in discovering some of these early writings? Like, are you down in the caves, like looking around with, you know, like a headlamp on and stuff?
Oh, no. Well, as I say, those there are known, if you know what I mean. So actually, an Ulm writing in Ireland is most common in the south of the country. There's only 6 recorded here in County Roscommon, where I am as well. 3 of them are on the landscape here, Cruachan. One of them is at a church site off to our east. And 2 of them are incorporated into the man-made souterrain that you're talking about there. One of them would be to Tim's right, but it's actually to the right-hand side of you. That passage is collapsed, so we can't read it. It can't be read. We can just see there's an Ulm inscription on it. But that one where you are there, it's in very good condition. You can see it's in out of the elements. It's been well preserved. It's easily read within that as well. But that's known to be there, if you like, for at least a couple of hundred years as well. So I would love to discover something like that. So, but as I say, I get to look at it every day and it passed down underneath it.
Well, we'll send you some crawl space stickers, and maybe like behind one of those rocks, you can just like slap it there, and then like in a few, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years, I'll throw some dirt on it and be like, holy shit, this is, how long has this been here? My God.
They're a company of antiquity. Yeah, for, they've been around for a long time, you know. So as I say, you could trace your origin all the way back.
Did this come from hell?
I suppose another, not from hell, but that cave as well. When you mentioned malevolence as well as an association, I think I mentioned a couple of stories, I suppose, there. I've mentioned 5 great Iron Age warriors associated with that cave. And this site here of Rathquahan is really a place where sometimes archaeology and mythology overlap, because we think that could be an echo of what the cave and its purpose was actually used for, because it's also recorded in all those medieval texts as the home of the Irish goddess of war, and her name is the Morrigan. So Mór in Irish means big or great. A Rí is a king, a Rí Gan, a queen. So Morrigan, which is a great queen or a phantom queen. Now, as I say, she's a battle goddess, but she doesn't partake in battle herself. She incites terror throughout her armies as well, so, and mayhem. So that's her job as well. That cave where you're sitting there, as I say, Tim, you're a brave man to sit there. I don't know what I sit there for as long as you are. That cave is recorded in all our medieval texts. It's her fit abode, her dwelling place, where she guards the entrance to the other world and makes her way between the two realms. Now, this Morrigan figure, very famously, she's a shape-shifting goddess. So the most common form that she's associated with is that of the crow. And you could think why that might be. If you could think of the remains on a battlefield, you're going to see the crows, aren't you, picking along among the remains. So that's one of the most famous shapes she's associated with. But she also joined the Thann to attack Cú Chulainn, this very famous warrior again. And initially at the beginning of the Thann, in the form of a beautiful maiden, she approaches him and offers him her love, and he rejects her. And this infuriates her, and she vows to hinder him throughout his life and also to be there at his death. So years later, when Cú Chulainn eventually meets his death, and the Morrigan, she alights down on his shoulder in the form of a crow to let the warriors who surround him know that he's finally dead. She's fulfilled her prophecy and takes her revenge upon him as well. So as you say, you're also sitting in the home of an Irish goddess of war. And that's what we think that cave could have been used for back in the past, as a initiation place for young warriors as well. As you head down into the bowels of it, it's completely dark. So there's no natural light. It's always the one temperature. It's always about 8 degrees centigrade. In fact, souterrains generally were associated with ring forts, early dwelling sites. And a large function we proposed to them would have been used as a cellar, actually, underground area, like a fridge, a storage place for food. And you could see, actually, maybe that's where an association of a different flow of time came from. The time would flow differently, as food wouldn't seem to spoil so quickly in these underground areas as well. So it's cool down there. There's no natural sound, no matter what it's doing outside, if it's raining, if it's sunny, if it's spring, if it's summer, it's always the same down there. It's quite disorientating. So if you like, we think it would have been used as a testing ground where young warriors, as part of a warrior society, would take themselves down in the dark on their own to face the Morrigan into the bowels of the earth, to literally be reborn as a rite of passage. Every culture is something like that, if you like, a traumatic event that you have to pass through, I suppose, to prove your passage from youth to adulthood. We call it secondary school or high school, is it, or the Leaving Cert or SATs or whatever you call it there as well. So I suppose that's what we go through as well. But we think at a time, if you like, of a warrior society, to take yourself down there in a ceremonial site where you're sitting in the middle of there, down into the dark of the earth, to literally be reborn. Even the morphology of it is like a birth canal down into the earth. To go down, a boy, to re-emerge a man, a proof of yourself and a part of society. And we think because of the stories associated with it, the home of the Irish goddess of war and all the warriors who were tested there, we've mentioned Freyach, Cú Chulainn, Conall, Lyra and Nera, they all go through the mill there. They don't have an easy time of it. And we think that could be an echo, if you like, of its use in earlier times and its purpose and its construction. So as I say, Tim, you'll definitely be a warrior for all that time you spent down in there. You've got your stripes. No one's going to mess with you now.
Well done. Well done. Yeah.
I hope not. They better not.
So can you kind of take us through what it's like to take a tour with you? Because you're one of the tour guides. And yeah, can you take us through that? Like if Tim and I were to book tickets and fly over there?
Yeah, absolutely. I wish he would. So soon, as I say, maybe as I say, the way the world is opening up again, soon enough he'll be able to do that. So what we do is we take people initially out. We start off here in the medieval village of Tulse, because, as I say, this site here of Rathcrohan, it's the prehistoric royal site, is Connaught, a centre of large gatherings. We head out to the central monument of the entire complex. As I say, there's 240 various monuments here, which is Rathcrohan Mound. And that's, if you like, where a large geophysical survey has revealed that it's a ceremonial site as well. Now, we've got 6,000 years of activity on the landscape here. So this area of the country is a limestone plain. So it's very fertile. It produces very fertile grassland, very good for raising cattle, if you like, as well. So a bit actually like, I think I'm told by some of our visitors from the States, very like Kentucky is a very rich limestone plain as well, and good fertile farmland as well, which probably gives us the very best reason why people are here in the first place. As I say, back at that time, 6,000 years ago, when you begin to get the first settled farmers in Ireland as well, when you're directly dependent, as I said, in your environment for your landscape or environment for your survival, good land is going to be everything to you. So we have evidence. So we head out to the central site and we go through, if you like, the history of the area, the time span of it. So we have the central ritual mound of Rathcrohan. We have 28 identified burial mounds, the high status of the Bronze and Iron Age tiles. So Rathcrohan has a number of functions. As I say, it's a site of assembly, it's a site of royal inauguration, but it's also recorded again in our medieval texts as one of the three great pre-Christian cemeteries of Ireland, or a burial ground for kings, along with Newgrange, a place you might have heard of, and Taltu in County Meath as well. So, as I say, we're on a landscape of ceremony, we're on a landscape of royal inauguration, but we're also in a place of a high-status prehistoric cemetery as well. So a very sacred ground over a very, very long period of time. And so we would point out all of those various monuments, and we would talk about how people lived, what they did, their lifestyles, and we interweave then the stories from our epic literature of the Thornbow Cooney, the Cattle Raid of Cooley, of Queen Maeve, Cú Chulainn, Conor MacNessa. And then we take people around, just to finish off, just to where you guys are there, or where Tim is there, around to the cave. And we give an overview of some of the stories, rituals, customs associated with that. And then when we finish, we offer them a very muddy slide down into the bowels of it, if they wish. Not everyone likes to do that as well, because it's not a very appetizing appetizing journey as well. But for people who wish, at the end, we slide them down right down into the center of the cave and turn off the lights and leave them there for a few minutes and bring them back up.
That would be terrifying.
Well, I suppose that's terrifying. We like a bit, not too terrifying, but we like to have a bit of fun with it as well, you know. So, so we ham it up a little bit, and so scare them a little bit, and then bring them down. But we always bring them back again. I've never left anyone behind, you know. So, and to say that when they come out, they're all warriors, just like you are now, Tim.
And has anything weird happened? Has anyone come out and said, like, oh, I felt a hand touch my shoulder or something like that? Anything kitschy?
Any cats?
Yeah, cats. No. Well, there's actually the house next door has a cat that tends to kind of wander over kind of quite a time. And he's quite a distraction, actually, if you're trying to do a tour and, like, maybe you have kind of, you know, 20 or 30 people, and then a cat shows up and they all go chasing the cat, and you kind of go, because they're at the cave of the cats. He can break your concentration somewhat. But it's interesting what you say there, Lance, because this is an unusual place, because you get quite a mix of people coming here. So a lot of people are interested, say, in the history here. A lot of academic archaeologists are interested in here. A lot of people, all of these stories of Cú Chulainn and Queen Maeve, these are things that we'd learn when we're small in national school. Everyone would be aware of them. So a lot of people like that, and they come here for that reason. And then a lot of people come here with the spiritualistic agenda, if you like, as well. Now, that wouldn't be anything to say that would personally interest me, but what's always lovely is that you could get a blend of people, from an academic to someone who wants to commune with the earth, all together in one group that probably never would come together under usual circumstances, and they all would get along very, very well, because we spend a couple of hours out and about and in around as well. So it brings a huge spectrum of different people for different reasons together. As I say, they probably wouldn't usually come together under normal circumstances. And I always think that's a lovely thing. as well. And yet they're all here for different reasons. They like this landscape for different ideas. But yet, as I say, they all get something out of it. And I think that's a nice thing. There's something here, for everybody to take away and out of it as well. And a huge thing actually for people from your side of the pond is that Halloween, I'm assured, has become quite a massive festival there, hasn't it? You know, so in the last kind of 20, 30 years, and it's become very big here as well, bigger and bigger. But I think that they really get a kick out of the fact that you're getting back to a real origin point, if you like, for some of those customs and stories associated with it. So I think, and especially it's such an innocuous monument now, as I say, it's on someone's private farmland. It's not really visible from the earth up and around. It's just a narrow little entrance in the verge of a road. It would originally have been in the center of a structure. It's completely destroyed now. Or the small road runs over the top of it that would have been built in the 1950s. So I think they really find something nice in that, you know, and something I suppose they can associate all the way back to their own childhoods, like, which is always a nice thing, you know, so. And something we all have in common worldwide as well. So.
Yeah, for sure. And that makes me a bit curious about what level of tourism you desire out there, because here we have spooky locations. Mm-hmm. Is that something, are you content with sort of, because I had never heard of this.
I would think, say, of the royal sites in Ireland, and like Rathcrohan might be one of the most maybe sometimes neglected or forgotten, because the western half of the country, if you like, especially this midwestern part here, would often be forgotten. It would be of low population. Really, the activity in Ireland is in the east around Dublin. That's where the population, kind of the nerve centre, the kind of all the work is now, and where the majority of the population lives. And so Rathcrohan, if you like, we'll be looking at the visitor centre here, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, might have been at quite a low ebb. But we would have just in the last year before COVID had our best year, if you like, visitor wise. And we've also been very busy this year. But there's a level too, isn't there? I mean, you can overdo something, but I don't think we would be in danger of that. And a monument like we're talking about there, I mean, we'll be doing some tours next week around Halloween. We'll maybe take 8 or 10 people at a time. There's not really much more that you would take into that. It probably wouldn't work as a large theme attraction, because it would destroy it. It wouldn't preserve it. So as I say, with Rathcrohan, we like to do more and more and more with it, but far things are going in the right direction. So as I say, we're getting more and more awareness, more and more support, but there's a level too where things can be overdone, can't they? And they can be theme parked and possibly put into danger then by that too, you know? So
I just think you need a parking garage and a few billboards with neon signs, like real big ones, like Las Vegas big.
Like really kitsch it up, like, you know, so maybe a monorail out from the center, out to the side, you know. And
I was going to say that too. Yeah.
Something you can see from space at least. You know?
Yeah. And during the entire month of October, get some nice creepy up lighting in there. some of that fake spider webs. Maybe have like animatronics jumping out at people.
Yeah, big cats everywhere.
We rely on our stories to scare people. And what we basically do, we basically like have a bag of torches and we slide people down in single file, because as I say, it's a narrow crawl space where you're coming in, you crawl down in, you slide down on your bum, you crawl out on your knees. Now down there, it's substantial. You have 7 meters up above your head, but if you like, to get in there is not so easy. And it wouldn't lend itself to, if you like, a massive sort of tourist attraction. I think that's a nice thing, because I think that's going to be its protection in the long run, its geographic location. And the fact also that, as I say, it can only kind of take so much. And it's not an easy thing to find, because, as I say, it's on private farmland. So it's not well signposted or anything like that. We have an information panel and some other kind of things like that there as well. But I think that's a thing that'll maybe help to preserve it, so as a good thing. So there's a level or a balance. We wouldn't be quite there yet, as I say. We always like to kind of do a little bit more and promote and keep it as well. But if you like, it can be its advantage too, because it hasn't been theme parked, it hasn't been spoiled. So I think people find it as it's naturally evolved, and I think people really appreciate that when they come to it. If that makes sense.
Oh, that makes total sense. And our follow-up episode for this will be Tim and I with our GoPros taking a tour going through, and then we can figure out a location where we can do a live show, because I'm 100% bought in on all of this.
Oh yeah, you have to come visit us. Yeah, absolutely, we'll take it. Bring your best clothes, your white suit, and we'll take you down into the mud, you know, and get it as possibly as dirty as we can.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.